And welcome to Here We Stand. It's July 5th, 2020. This is your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. Here, as always, that is Hazel Dickens singing from the coal fields of West Virginia. They'll never keep us down. Hazel knew how to be self-reliant. So do people who are involved in struggle. And that's what we're doing here today on the program, as every week. This is the voice of the Republic and the Resistance, the program that undistances you from the truth and arms you to take back your mind and your world. We are part of the global movement to establish common law republics, specifically the Republic of Kanata, formerly the Dominion of Canada. Find our work at Republic of Kanata, that's K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca, and murderbydecree.com. Well, today I'm blessed once again to be joined by my co-host, Deb Golding, and she's going to come on in a minute after these important announcements. Deb and I are going to do a dialogue diagnosis about what we're up against, not at the obvious superficial level, but the mass psychosis that we're presently engaged in as a society that really not a lot of us can get away from unless we start taking back our minds first. And in that light, actually, I got just 10 minutes ago, I got this really cool announcement from one of my friends in Sacramento, California. Well, folks have remembered how over the years we've been talking about this butcher called Junipero Serra. He was a Franciscan missionary who worked to death over 100,000 indigenous men, women, and children in California in the late 18th century. Well, Smiley Frank, the Pope, so-called Pope Jorge Bergoglio, winged his way over to California a few years ago and made the guy a saint, saying, "We are inspired by his zeal." Well, guess what some folks in Sacramento did this morning? They put some ropes around the statue and pulled it down and knocked it into little pieces. Now, of course, we got to do more than pull down statues of butchers, people. We got to pull down the child killers and the tyrants that are doing this to us all today. But it's a good start going after the statues. And in that regard, I want to also remind folks that we are experiencing quite a growth across Kanata. I'll tell you, normally over the last 4 or 5 months, the number of people who volunteered have increased about fourfold. We're averaging about 25 to 30 people a week wanting to get on board, help form common law republics. And as part of that, as some of you know, we've been setting up common law assemblies. There's now in 44 communities across Kanata, there are people either trying to form or who have established common law assemblies. Half of those are in Ontario, 22 of them, the rest in the West and the Maritimes and Quebec. But the thing about these assemblies is that they're self-governing bodies. They're mini republics on which the larger republic is built because we believe in local self-governance, direct democracy. Now, we've been talking about doing flag raisings across Canada, but this is not something we do lightly. We're raising the flag of the republic, and you can see the details, republicofkanada.ca. But along with that, we're issuing the thing that's been out for a while on our websites. That's the Proclamation of Independence that was reissued just a while ago by the Movement of the Republic. When we raise these flags, it's not just a gesture. We are actually reclaiming those areas as liberated zones outside Crown jurisdiction. So once we do that, we take it seriously. We have to defend those places. We have to find those people willing to defend their communities against the incursions of the Crown and the tyrannical police state that we're all immersed in right now. So in other words, we're asking people to do this, but in a very serious way. Are you able and willing to defend what you claim? So that's an issue before all of us. And the focus in a lot of our training, of course, is not only defending ourselves and training local common law sheriffs, but educating people and consolidating core group leaderships in all of these different communities. That's why we do our workshops and everything. If you want to be part of that, write to republicofkanata@gmail.com. And like I said, republicofkanata.ca is the website. There'll be more on that website soon. It's going up this week, a lot more content. Well, on that note, welcome to Deb. Hello, Deb.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for having me on again today.
It's a delight. Let me tell you, it's delightful to have you on because
delightful to be here. I look forward to this.
Well, good. I mean, I love the way we balance each other. You tend to go into the personal. I tend to talk about the social, but they're two aspects of the same thing. I meant to tell you too. I've got a treat in store. There's a guy called Utah Phillips. He's a legendary folk singer from Utah, and we're going to play some of his reflections at the halfway point today. But I thought, you know, you come in from Utah and Salt Lake City, everyone thinks it's just about Mormons, but no, it's had a long kind of radical tradition out in the West, and it's free-thinking bastion, actually, Utah for many years. So we're going to hear him too. But let me ask you, you know, I've been talking about all this stuff. What I want to really talk about, one of the things today, is this psychosis, this mass psychosis we're immersed in. And I want to break it down and look at some of that. Any thoughts on that first from you before we get into it?
The mass psychosis I'm extremely familiar with, because that is actually that's a really good label, or another way to identify the way I was raised in the Mormon Church. It's very, very communal. You'll find very loyal people within the church, because they all think, I want to say they all think the same. And then what I was raised with, and I remember being a part of this, there's a lot of security that came with that, because you felt like you belonged and all of, you know, those kinds of things. And yet there was this strange aspect that it was very, the boundaries within the church culture, the Mormon communities, the boundaries are very porous. So because of the way the structure of the church itself is set up, it allows and encourages basically people to be in each other's business and know what's going on with each other. And it's really great, you know, you want to frame it, or it's framed as in we're here taking care of the herd and we're aware of each other, but there's a lot of personal questions that get asked and are shared, and there's a lot of information that goes on. Plus, twice a year, the church has a very formal mass gathering. They call it the General Conference. And so in April and October of every year, they will broadcast worldwide to their members, and then they have this gigantic building, the conference center, that holds thousands of members, and you bring them in, and that is, it is very true. It's a very real, you know, response to feel that you're one, but really just train into this mass psychosis, this mass mind thinking, and it propagates itself.
Religion is especially, you know, set up to, you know, perpetrate a psychotic delusion among people. But the topic for today's show, undistancing ourselves from the mass psychosis, lessons from our struggle. I know that both of us have been through this in different ways. When we're talking psychosis, you know, it's, you look at the textbook definition, but the interesting thing is that there's individual psychosis, which often comes from sustained trauma in your life. You basically become totally dissociated. And, you know, there's the old saying, I remember when I was taking psychology, our prof said, neurotics build castles in the sky and psychotics live in them. And it's kind of like you're so detached from reality, you're living in this alternative reality. And it's really bizarre, because that can happen to a whole society as well. Collective obsession or mass psychosis. And what, you know, I had this thought, I want your comment about this. I don't think this virus is a physical reality. I think it's a cyber reality. It's an idea put out on the internet. I have been very active for the last 3 to 4 months. I have yet to find anyone who's sick with it. I don't believe it exists. Mm-hmm. If people are getting sick, it's for other reasons. And, you know, there's different theories about that, the effects of toxicity and the 5G electronics and all that. Could be any reason for crashing our immune system. Living in this toxic environment, I'm not surprised. But everyone believes it's out there. And the psychosis is most concentrated at the top of society. We see that when empires fell apart, right? It's the emperors and the rulers that are the craziest and make the weirdest decisions. And everyone shuffles along because we've lived in a hierarchical system where everyone obeys right down the ladder. I mean, you look around and you think, well, if the police and the department stores and the ferries and the government are all saying distance, then I guess it must be real. No, it's a psychotic delusion. And it doesn't actually exist. It only exists when you plug into the cyber world of the internet. You look around in the everyday world, I don't see anything. Your thoughts about all that?
Well, there's many. So I you're right in that it is really, really supported by so many things around it. And so it feeds itself from my, you know, from what I viewed, it feeds itself basically because we have these desires. It delivers what we want if we comply. So through our social shaming and through interactive policing of each other, and you know, what on either side of that of the mask of the 6 foot distancing of isolating or not isolating, on either side of this, there's still a human desire to do what you need to do, which is, I need to work, or I need to get to the grocery store, or I whatever the need is. And so when there are mandates, quote unquote, or suggestions, quote unquote, set out there by local authorities, whatever your government situation is, or even the store that you're wanting to access says, this is what we're adhering to per CDC, you know, per these rules and per these suggestions, and we choose to adhere to them, then what okay. you want, in order to get what you want, you are complying. And yet, that
stop right there.
Even if it is right on the if it's created and fake, we're still supporting its reality.
That's what I want to ask you. People obey, okay, and that's the first thing mm-hmm. we got to break this down, because we operate with assumptions that aren't real, right? Well, why would someone obey it? And one of the I want to just give folks some sources to read. There's a guy, Wilhelm Reich, who wrote a book. His books were burned by both the Nazis and the American government in the 1950s. He was a psychologist, and he wrote an amazing book called The Mass Psychology of Fascism, where he analyzed psychologically why people choose totalitarian regimes, even though it goes against all their interests. And it's very relevant for today. And so one of the things he talks about is something, it kind of echoed what you said once about your own traumatization and torture as a young child in the satanic cults within the Mormon church. You talked about mm-hmm. trauma training. Could you just give an example of what that is?
Trauma training would definitely be, there's a lot of examples, but the first thing that comes to my mind, honestly, is from my experience, there I was put through a number of exercises. That's a really, really gentle word. I'm sorry. A trauma experience, terrifying performance rituals is a better way to put it. Where I was in a place where there would be something I needed to either solve a puzzle, or I needed to perform certain actions, and there was a time frame that had to be done within, so that really on the other end there was either a person, a child, a baby, or an animal that was going to either suffer or die. And typically it ended up in death, whether it was prolonged suffering or not. But it was all dependent upon me to save this child, this being, this animal, whatever it is. So I, against the clock, I had the choice to solve a puzzle or to do something one particular way or another particular way, and I had to evaluate which way to do it. And once I made that choice, then I had to perform the task. And the horrible thing is that this entire situation was set up that for me to lose every single time. The thing was going to die. Yeah. The person, the baby, was going to be killed.
How was it going to die?
Oh my gosh! It depended on really what the setup was. And it was always gory, and it was always blood. So it would be something like an axe coming down upon it, or something. There was something already there, and so there was not another person or another entity that I could even associate, you know, an action with. The whole thing always came back to me. So there was like a contraction set up, and I have to trip it, I have to make it right, and if I don't, then it doesn't happen. So this trauma training created a situation where I was unable to really trust my soul, my own decisions, and my own problem solving.
Well,
so then I
more
would
than that.
Automatically revert to a authority and anybody that knew better than me, and obviously that would be whoever I identified as the authority in a situation,
you're,
a teacher, a policeman.
It's making you feel responsible
official.
For the death. Okay, here's the thing though, it's more than that. It's making you feel personally responsible for the death of that child rather than the people who actually killed the child, right?
That's exactly right. Yes, the whole setup. I didn't have
okay.
Because I was also in a drug state, I wasn't looking at the whole thing and going, wow, you know, my choice is neither, none of this. I'm walking away. I was in such a traumatized situation, plus having the drugging there. And also now this is happening enough times in my life that there's almost a familiarity that I kick into a different personality or
okay.
state
but
of
you're a
being.
Child, too.
As
you're
a child.
You can't
right.
fight,
and
you know. Yeah.
You can't, no. There's no way out. So the only choice that I had was what was in front of me, and I didn't really have the ability to choose outside of that, to be curious about how to problem solve this. Oh, hell no. There is something that is happening. It's time effective. I need to do it within a time frame, and I need to do this right because if I don't, something's going to die.
Okay, so here's the thing. I want to draw an analogy. What do we get every time you walk into a store and you walk against the arrow, so you don't stand 6 feet apart? The store owner says to you, basically, you're going to be responsible if my business crashes, right? Because they'll take my license away. So the system of tyranny is set up of self-policing. People police each other and make everyone responsible as if we're going to cause the problem, not the government. So it's a direct analogy, and this is why I'm saying that the trauma training techniques are the same. The people who did that to you in the Mormon Church, heavily connected, as we know, the Mormon Church connected not only the Catholic Church, but the U.S. government and the CIA. They recruit disproportionately out of the Mormon Church. These mind control techniques are tried out in churches and then deployed on the general population. So this is why your experience is really crucial for people knowing how to psychologically fight this tyranny right now.
Well, it, you know what, and I want to add something that would be an everyday experience. Like, this actually happened to me. So, you know, it might be a little bit of a stretch for people to relate to what I just described. However, there was, because in church, I had a mindset that I really wanted to be as fluent in my religion and in the Word of God, the Bible and the Book of Mormon, as I could possibly be, because to me, that was exactly where I was headed. I wanted, that's just part of my personality too. So I created a situation where I was fairly well-versed. And so when I would be in Sunday school class, and I was not the teacher at the time, I would be sitting in, you know, the classroom setting. Somebody would say, you know, the teacher would pose a question. And I had this tendency to, because I'm a curious being, raise my hand and say, have you considered this and this? And then I would back it up with our own scripture. This is stuff from, you know, from the Bible, but I'm also going to bring in the Book of Mormon pretty heavily because this is what, you know, this is what the religion is based off of. So I would do that enough that it got kind of, you know, like there were people that would come up to me like, wow, I haven't ever thought of that. That's really great. However, there were a few men, and I can think of some very specific situations. I'll talk about one at this moment where a man pulled me aside. He was a very authoritative older man, and he said, you know, your opinion goes against the prophet, right? And I said, well, does it? He said, it does, and you're wrong. And I said, I guess we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one because I see it backed up by God. I see it backed up by our scripture. So he shows up the next week with a book, and the book was a Mormon book. I even, you know, and he had a section underlined, and he walked up to me. He says, you know, I'd like to share something with you here. He handed me the book, opened it up to the page, pointed to the paragraph he had underlined, and I said, wow, you know what? Thank you for sharing that with me. I actually have this book. I've read this book, and I still think, you know, we still need to agree to disagree. And he looked at me, and he says, of everyone, you're wrong because your opinion is not of the prophets, and you better repent.
Okay, so how does that relate to the trauma? So tell me how that relates to the trauma training.
What I'm trying to say is, basically, I had a chance to, I was trying to really just kind of say, hey, look, here's something, I want to pose a different idea, let's walk against the arrows here for a moment, and immediately, you know, people, and it was more than just this gentleman, people were really, really, like, upset about that, and so I was getting pushback, like, you better get back in here, and you better conform. And this is far enough down the line, and I do need to counter to say this. This was probably months before I finally left the church. So I was really well into my I'm done with this phase. And I wasn't being belligerent, but I was seeing this clearer than I'd ever felt seen before.
Let's get beyond the whole issue of the Mormon Church here for a minute, because it's a whole wider thing. The thing is about churches is they're so esoteric, people consider them kind of strange to start over with. They don't see what the relation is between what's going on in society. But the whole issue that you're illustrating, I think, has to do with how do people get so controlled that they go against their own self-interest? They rely on authoritarian systems. And we're seeing it play out right now. And it's a practical question because all these communities I go into where people they talk about common law assemblies, but it's like the macho guy, he climbs a 10-meter diving board, he walks over to the edge, looks down, and then chickens out and walks down the ladder again. That's the experience of most people who claim they want to set up common law assemblies. they talk about it, but then they don't actually take the final step to say, okay, we're signing the charter, we're a governance, let's start taking back power. They won't do it, by and large. And, you know, I want to explore why that is. And, you know, I know that you have some...
themselves. Yeah, no, honestly, it comes down to very basic things. Is it's not supported. I don't know very many people that are raised with an open enough parenthood that says, you know what, let's experiment and let's play with our world enough here as you're, you know, like 5 years old and, you know, a teaching system that says, hey, you know what, experiment and play and trust your choices. So, I mean, that's kind of against everybody in the first place. But really what it comes down to is we don't trust ourselves to be strong enough to act. And so, you know what, you and I were talking about this.
Yeah, but why?
Once before.
Why is that?
And, well, because we are taken from crisis to crisis, right? It takes us up, and what that does is it shortens our memory, which creates dissociated thinking. And then from there, we become very uncertain, and we forget that it's happened before. We don't realize that it's going on because the stress and the crisis that's in front of us doesn't necessarily offer us time to look back and say, oh, I've been here before. Or to trust the fact that you might think that you have been here before.
Okay, now here's the thing. That term you use, crisis to crisis, we all know very well that this is how they operate. They hit you with one crisis after another. And Utah Phillips, who's going to talk a minute, talks about the long memory. People who remember previous generations and the lessons. And that's exactly, it's like everyone's been, have massive amnesia, and that's the characteristics of psychosis. You can't remember from before 3 minutes ago. And I get that all the time. People say, hey, Kevin, I heard that 50,000 children were killed in Canada in residential schools. And I said, yeah, that's what I surfaced 15 to 20 years ago. But people, it's being wiped out of their memory, even though we were making headlines and everything. And that's one example. And when you're operating in that environment, you can't really build because people go moment to moment. It's like being on a psych ward where people don't remember the day before. Literally, that's what I find myself in every week.
Right, right. And part of the situation with you is that I remember you telling the story that, you know, you were told back in 2008 that you would basically be eliminated. You're going to be, who you are on the internet is going to disappear. And, you know, kudos to you for staying with that, regardless of how that has worked out for you, because it has been brutal. And then for that to surface again, I think it is to remind people, it's like, well, this has been around. And the fact is, if you want to take it beyond what I've done and you want to go back and look at other countries in the genocide and other times in their genocide, you know, it's a common process. And then in the genocide, in the experience, there's such a pattern of, you know, giving them hope, giving hope or having hope, and then ripping it away. And then you get another chance, and then it rips away. And our own integrity wants to give our authority people, whoever those are, typically government or, you know, or even our abusers, well, give them another chance, you know? And we don't realize in the moment that the people we're trusting are the very people that are hurting us, right? There's a lot of such a thing in domestic violence where the victim is sitting there with broken bones and bruises, and the perpetrator, the partner, or whoever did it, walks into the room, and she doesn't want to press charges. Oh, give him another chance.
No.
It's like, you are sitting
classic
there broken.
Stockholm syndrome. I mean, everybody, the reality is, and this is what I wanted, we're coming up on the break already, and I wanted to say that one thing I wanted to talk about is how we're all in the soup. Right, we're all in the situation of mass psychosis, and the fallacy for people to think I'm more aware than you are. No, we all operate within the what's called, sometimes they call it the hegemonicon. It's like a group mind, and I want to talk about this when we come back from listening to Utah Phillips, because the hegemonicon governs the way we all think. It's the group mind, and it's what's interesting is in an exorcism, you don't address the individuals who are possessed, you address the entity possessing them. And I want to talk about that. It's a very practical, personal, and political question. It's also a spiritual question. I want to talk about that after the break, if you'd like
absolutely.
To go there with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay. So we're going to listen to Utah Phillips now, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Well, that comes in the Army. I was from Utah. Nobody ever heard of anybody from Utah. I have male call out in the street, and they holler out Utah, and I'm the guy who says, here, sir. So the name, you know, 60, it's like calling somebody Tex. if they're from Texas, or calling them Louise if they're from Louisiana, maybe, I don't know. So that the name just stuck. The U Utah, I've always been known as U Utah Phillips, and that comes, I guess I can say that now. That's been a closely held secret for years. When I was in Utah there, first learning the kind of music I love, my favorite singer was T. Texas Tyler. So my friend Norman Ritchie, the traveling teenage sage, started calling me U Utah Phillips. There you go.
So we're here with U Utah Phillips. And wars have defined so much. History books define times by war. But resistance is also there. And that's what often goes unchronicled, except with people like you, who have been chronicling the resistance movements for a long time. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the people who you feel have made important differences in activism, in resisting the wars.
Well, for that, I would have to go back to Union Brothers and Sisters. I would have to go back to the Espionage Act and the First World War. In my union, the Industrial Workers of the World, this is my 50th year in the IWW, by the way, my proudest association. It is the only organization I've ever known of that didn't break faith with its elders. Well, when I hit the road, when I went out to try to find out who I really was, to reconstruct my life, when I left Utah, I found those elders and I sought them out. I never thought I would be able to say this, Amy, but most of my elders, most of my great teachers were born the century before last. That I was born in the 1890s. And I think of Fred Thompson and the elders that I've talked to that went through the First World War as Unionists and endured the Espionage Act, endured the enormous persecution, and just kept at it and kept at it. That was an amazing thing because that was one of the effects of the war, and the same thing happened in the Second World War, was to use that super patriotism and to use the enhanced governmental powers to break the back of the labor movement, especially the radical labor movement, the IWW, and pretty damn well, you know, near succeeded. In spite of that, you know, of that terrible oppression and that awful war, we came out of that war with the beginning of the 8-hour day, with mine safety laws, with child labor laws, you know. We were still winning all the time we were losing.
For young people who've never heard of the Wobblies or the International Workers of the World, Industrial Workers of the World. Can you explain its origins?
Industrial Workers of the World grew out of the Western Federation of Miners. It started in 1905. The cornerstone of the IWW was the notion that people in the same industry should belong to the same union. Big Bill Haywood there in Colorado. Big Bill's a true American. He was one of the founders of the IWW. His father rode for the Pony Express. His mother was a 49er who got off the wagon train in Salt Lake. Bill was born in Salt Lake. There in Colorado, he'd see how a mine would get struck. So they'd bring in scabs to bring out scab ore, and then it would be transported to the mill on the union train and milled at the union mill. He said, all of the people in this industry should belong to one union, because that's union scabbing. So industrial unionism was born as an alternative to craft unionism, like the AFL, organized bodies of workers fighting against each other. And it wasn't just industrial unionism. It was the one big union, the OBU, a union of all skilled, semi-skilled, and unskilled workers in one big union, divided up into industrial departments, syndicalism, which would then replace the government. The means of production in the hands of the producers, produce for use instead of profit, create abundance for workers and nothing for parasites. An end to the wage system. Well, like John Greenway, he called the IWW a banzai charge on capitalism, and that was about right. Well, of course, the union dwindled, you know, after the First World War, the Palmer Raids, which were so much worse than anything we're experiencing now. It still survived, and now the union is growing. It's been growing for quite a long time now.
The Palmer Raids?
No, the Industrial Workers of the
World.
Right,
but the Palmer Raids, if you could say what they were, again, for people who...
Oh, Attorney General Palmer That was the first Red Scare, the first big Red Scare. The Russian Revolution had been accomplished right at the, you know, during the First World War. So the first big Red Scare happened when Attorney General Palmer caused thousands of unionists to be jailed and many, many immigrant workers to be deported without any kind of due process. And it was like an industrial war, and Palmer did their best to break up the IWW, and they never succeeded because we have survived and we have persisted.
You talk about the Palmer raids. You talk about the Espionage Act. How do you think the time we're living in now compares?
I think it can get as bad. I think that we're being frog marched into a corporate fascist takeover of the country, and no fooling. I think that we're in the Weimar Republic, and that's another thing that I would encourage young people to understand. That was Germany before the Second World War, the rise of Hitler, the rise of Nazism. Why didn't people do anything? The big question that young Germans are asking their grandparents, why didn't you do something? Read about the Weimar, compare the rise of fascism in Germany from the 1920s to what's happening right here, right now. The long memory is the most radical idea in America. That long memory has been taken away from us. Listen, you young people, don't talk to you. That long memory has been taken away from you. You haven't gotten it in your schools. You're not getting it on your television. You're not getting it anywhere. You're being leapfrogged from one crisis to the next. You know, you can't remember what happened last week because you're locked into this week's crisis. No. Turn that off, you know, walk away from that, walk out your front door, go find your elders, go find your two elders, go find your people that lived that life, who knew that life, and who know that history, and get your hands down into that deep, rich stream of our people's history. We divided our culture up into a market for youngers, a market for young adults, a market for young marrieds, a market for older people, you know. It's not that way. And mass media contributed that by taking the great movements that we've been through and trivializing important events. No, our people's history is like one long river. It flows down from way over there, and everything that those people did and everything they lived flows down to me, and I can reach down and take out what I need if I have the courage to go out and ask questions. That huge river, you know, that it's like tributaries that flow down into the polluted river and purify it.
And we're back. Yuta Phillips, beautiful man. You know, it reminds me, Deb, of when I was growing up in the 70s, I would meet all these old guys, right, who had been involved in amazing struggles during the Depression and before that, just to get people's basic rights, you know, the sacrifices they had to make. And they were really simple people, like humble people, like they wouldn't think of taking any money for themselves if somebody else was hungry. And that kind of cooperativism and support among each other, it's been like so eradicated around us, and people don't have a memory of this, what Yuta Phillips calls that living river of tradition. And so anyway, I just thought I should mention that because it brought a tear to my eye.
It reminded me
a lot of guys I knew.
What a beautiful commentary that was. I mean, I really enjoyed listening to it. The idea of the long memory is so accurate with what he was saying there, which actually leads me to a question. Because of the span of time here, I would love to know what you meant about exorcism and what your experience of it has been. If you'd share that, that'd be great.
Right. Well, I mentioned that before because, I mean, it's not a particularly vague idea. It's a reality that there's different realities that govern us. And, you know, we don't see air molecules, but we know they exist. We breathe them. And there's these other realities. And as a minister and then later in Rome, I was engaged in several exorcisms. And what was really, I'll talk about the significant one, the one that happened in Rome, where I was standing in St. Peter's Square with the soil of children who died in these, murdered and buried en masse in these Catholic Indian schools in Canada. And something just came over to me to call out the spirit of that place. I just called it the spirit of Rome. And I told it to come forth and expose itself and stand naked and then be gone. You know, it's thousands of years of violence and corruption in that spot, right? And the next day, a tornado hits the city of Rome, first time in 45 years. And then the naming of that occurred in the European press that same week. Pope Benedict at the time, Joseph Ratzinger, was named for the first time that week. Okay, so, wow. You know, as somebody who was engaged in child trafficking and cover-up. Now, what happened there, I didn't cause that, but I was at the center of a storm there, of the energy and the thoughts and the lives that Living River, Utah Phillips talks about, was flowing through me and confronting that thing and saying, stand down, and it did. It shows you the power we have. But what I was addressing there, I wasn't addressing the Pope or any of his minions, because they're all in a state of possession. Okay, the higher up you go in this social system, the more possessed you are. And the more blind you are, which is weird why people would elect people to government or not govern themselves, because it's, you know, we're relying on crazy psychotic individuals. But I addressed what in the Bible they call the angel of the church, or the overmind, you know, they call it the hegemonicon. It's like the group mind that governs all of us. And you address that thing, and you're hitting it at its Achilles heel, because it's what governs everybody's thoughts. And I don't know if that's too vague, but it's a lived reality. I experience it all the time. You know, and another example of that is people believe, oh, we live in a free society. It's kind of a hegemonic idea. But no, you break down, we do. No, look at your experience every day. We don't. And so you create that germ of an idea that things are not as we've been told they are. Right. And people start thinking, and their own experience says, hey, I've been fed lies every day. I can say no. I can walk away. I don't have to go along with these arbitrary rules and tyranny. So that's really the essence of an exorcism. You are calling out the power behind the appearance. And you are saying that once I take back my own power, I have infinite power to confront that and bring it down. And rather than just standing there impotently hoping for somebody else to do the change for you. Kind of in a nutshell.
To do the change. Right. So then you're taking that, being sovereign in what it is that you're acting on. But I found that interesting too. So you named it the angel of the church, like, as the overmind. And that kind of surprised me, because I'm more familiar with, in the book of Revelations, you know, this presence, or this thing that is referred to as the beast, you know, like the number of the beast, and then, you know, the beast with all of the heads, and what that is. I was kind of used to thinking that that was what needed to be named. And so I'm finding it really fascinating that you identified it as the angel of the church, being as there's an overmind. Where did that come from for you?
Well, it's a term used in, if people read in the epistles, those are the letters after the New Testament that Paul writes to various churches in Asia Minor, early Christian churches. He never says to the people of the Church of Ephesus. He'll say to the angel of the Church of Ephesus. He's addressing its group mind. And what the reality is here is that, and there's this quote, and it always intrigued me. Henry Thoreau, he was an American writer in the mid-1800s, he wrote this. He's the first one who used the term civil disobedience, on the duty of civil disobedience, of saying no to the government. And he says, I was not born to be forced. I will breathe after my own fashion. Let us see who is the strongest, me or the state. Now, he knows he's stronger than the state, because the state is an illusion. It's a fiction created by this group mind that has everybody in the state of possession. And as soon as you say, okay, well, what is the state? Is it the guy who's going to lock me up? Well, I just speak to him and say, they put Thoreau in jail for not paying taxes, because they didn't like the Mexican-American War. But they let him out after a day, because he just talked to the guy and said, what have I done wrong? I'm just not paying for war. And they agreed with him, and the judge let him go. So, I mean, that's like what we've done time and again with this campaign. They say, how did 2,000 people force Canada to admit genocide when they didn't want to? Because they couldn't deny it, and their own angel was aching to let it go and acknowledge. And that's because good and evil are just projections of our own dissociated mind, right?
Right.
The reality is
right.
One.
We want to see what we want to see. Yeah. The reality
we're in a state of dissociation, living in this crazy mm-hmm. culture, and we have to be functionally dissociated to function in a culture like this. And so we project that on the universe and think of good and evil, God and the devil, us and the enemy. Everyone is at war with each other right now because there's mass psychosis going on. And it's interesting, mm-hmm. going back to that notion of mass psychosis, it's a symptom of a society that suffered unresolved trauma, either from a war, plague, or invasion. And it results mm-hmm. in permanent disassociation and eventual collapse of the whole culture. And that's what we see going on in North America especially, right? It's like the war and violence we have inflicted on this ourselves here on this continent, on indigenous people, on people all over the world, uh-huh. it's blowing back. The war has come home, like the Vietnam vets say. We're warring to the death with each other because it's our collective psychosis, and nobody can name it. It's like when we tried to name the genocide. Still to this day, people pretend in Canada it never went on in those residential schools, wow. right? No one's ever been tried. We're pretending it didn't happen.
That is where that long memory is so valuable.
Right.
And then I've got a couple questions for you, though. I was curious about, you know, you talk about the mass psychosis. You've been really eloquent in describing that. But I'm, you know, why do people choose authoritarianism when it goes against our basic self-interest, you know? And then the other question on that is, well, you know, what has allowed you to help people act and think differently? What experiences have you had where you've seen that happen?
I want to talk about the second one first, because these are really important questions. Like, I realize it's funny, I'm 64 now. I've become the elder that Utah Phillips is. Or was. I think he's dead now. But and I remember 45 years ago, when I was getting involved in different campaigns, I would automatically look to people who had been through it because they've got all this hard battle experience. And from my practical experience, what changes people is when there's one of two things that can happen. Either as individuals, they've reached the limit and they say, that's it. That's enough. My back is to the wall. I've got to fight, right? Either they're pushed that far mm-hmm. or things are so coming down around them that they automatically look to something new. And that's why we have to provide something new. You can't go into a time of social upheaval without an alternative ready. Because if you don't have that alternative ready for people, there's no way out. They don't even think in terms of change. They just crawl off into their little holes. And that's why we say, look, we can create this republic right now. It already exists in our minds and hearts. We just have set up the structure, and people are responding. I remember a few days ago in Ottawa, Canada's capital, about four of our members went down to a big protest of about 3,000 people on Parliament Hill, and they had a couple of hundred leaflets about talking about our republic, they need to form common law assemblies. People were running up saying, hey, is this the Republic of Canada? Give me a bunch. I want to join. This is an idea whose time has come. We've got to take back power from these bastards. Like, you know, it just kind of blew their expectations.
Wow.
But that's where so many people are at right now, because we're creating an alternative they can join. Without that alternative, it's like steam without piston. You got to create the piston mm-hmm. to harness the steam. And this is the practical way of creating an alternative.
Well, it also speaks to the fact that people, I mean, what I was hearing you say, and I've experienced this myself too, people don't necessarily change unless you're compelled to do it. Like, it's an uncomfortable place to be, and then it gets even more uncomfortable and even more until you finally look at this and it's like, wow, I've got to change. But what's interesting is we often look outside ourselves and say, that situation has to change, and it's actually... There's an inner part of us that is ready for the change, and the outward is not just there to ask for the change, but you know, it's the mirror of what it is that is going inside of us, and it's not, you know, if we're used to the distractions and we get kind of, you know, gobbled up in the 3D distractions of what's going on, instead of really taking this inner spiritual esoteric kind of soulful stance on what in me is resonating here, or looking at this and feeling compelled to be different, then, you know,
and even the distinction between spiritual and material, I mean, I think it's a false distinction. Again, it's a projection of our dissociation. You know, it's like when Jesus said, oh, do you believe Jesus was fully divine or fully human? The point is, he was just a man, but he was a complete man. And that's divine. When we're completely human, that's our divine nature. We're empathic. We're loving. We're supportive. We're courageous. We don't look the other way. That's okay. That's enough. You don't need to be resurrected from the dead. That's what it means to be have heaven on earth. If people all live like that, you know, then we wouldn't have a problem. If we practiced mutual aid, if we took care of each other, we wouldn't need the government. But like you said, we were raised in a situation of learned dependency. We fear liberty because it involves responsibility. And it'd be better to just suck on the tit of the state than get up and act for yourself. And that's really, fear is really about clinging to this false security, I think, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, but see, then that kind of goes into, you know, the understanding of what the nature of power is. And, you know, what is that? What is it that we're actually looking for and clinging to, in your opinion?
Well, it's the illusion of power. The only power is within ourselves, right? There is no such thing as external power. Power only exists on our mind because we've surrendered it to somebody else by marking a ballot, by paying, you know, for groceries, by paying taxes, whatever. If we're self-sufficient and self-reliant, I mean, that's why the American Revolution happened, because you had all these self-sufficient farmers and communities that were already free and managing themselves. And that's why they fought the British. Reverse situation now. Nobody is free. Nobody knows what liberty is. You're born into a dependent existence, right? And so we talk about liberty, but people don't know what it is. They've never had any experience of it, any more than they've had any experience of Christianity. So a lot of it is just illusion, but you break through the illusion when you start practicing it. And we showed that when we started occupying these churches and they collapsed and started, you know, the government had to step in and start admitting some of these crimes. You strike at what is their source of money and prestige, and they always back down. They don't have power. Only we do. That's the reality, right?
Well, I think so. Then that point right there is really, really important, because you're speaking what the truth is, you know, the liberty versus the security aspect of what this is. And yet that also, in my mind, requires us as everybody, look at that and take that comment and say, well, how do I feel about that comment? And get really curious about it, because if there's anybody out there right now that just heard you say that and went full into like, ooh, I don't think so, full on rejection, you know, maybe I would encourage them to actually say, hey, you know what? Let's go back to the idea that there are, you know, cased choices here, and be curious about that comment. Be curious about the fact that there may be something else to a view, and then soften it, you know, soften it a little bit, because honestly, it is designed, the whole situation. And again, it was, you know, refined from my own experiences of testing and everything. The system is designed that they win. The outcome, regardless of, you know, they're going to hand you a loaded dice, a loaded deck of cards. And when we step in as the wild card and say, well, I brought my own deck, I have my own dice, that is not part of the scenario they've got going on. And they haven't factored that part in. And so this is taking back your own power, really. This is your self-awareness and your sovereignty. And really what it is, to care for yourself and for others and that kind of thing. I mean, you said once, and I really loved this, you said that people misunderstand the nature of power. Power is there to rule, not to care. And that is the truth. And so then what we do as people is we end up projecting our own light onto them instead of projecting the light onto ourselves. I can do that.
And here's the final thought, because
we're trained not to.
Yes, you're right. And we've got less than 5 minutes, so I just want to end with a question, because I don't know if there's an answer right now. But when we're talking about what's exploding all over the world now, it's easy to point fingers and say it's this plot by an elite to do it to us. Now, of course, that's victim thinking. Something being done to me means I'm helpless, that I don't contribute in any way. The reality is we are experiencing what we have sowed. Maybe this is a form of judgment, and I don't mean in a divine wrath kind of sense of judgment, but just a natural logical consequence of the way we've lived for centuries. You know, we have desecrated the earth and the people on it. We have created constant warfare in order for an elite to prosper, you know. 6% of the world's population on this continent has controlled 3/4 of the resources for a long time. And so how do you get that? By constant bloodshed, war, and genocide. This is blowback. We're now experiencing classic example. We're experiencing what we've done to others. Mandatory vaccinations have been a reality on Indian reservations in Canada and America for over a century. You cannot say no to having a needle shoved in the arm of your kid or you go to jail. That's life for an Indian. Well, hell, we've been doing that since the 19th century to people, but now they want to do it to us, and we're all crying blue murder. The reality is what you do to others will come back on you. And I think if that is the situation, and I know it's the situation, we have to think beyond the box as in, oh, how can I go back to the status quo? No, we don't want to go back to the status quo. We want to fundamentally change everything. You know, like we're talking revolution in a moral, mental, complete sense. It's like that slogan I saw on a wall in Chiapas, Mexico, right before the Zapatista uprising in 94. It said, somebody had scrawled, we don't want money, we don't want power, we want a new world. Okay.
Wow.
And that new world starts in our own head, but it extends outwards. And it starts by disassociating yourself, stepping away from a genocidal culture like Canada or America. Say, I'm not a citizen of this anymore. Look at the blood on our hands.
Right.
You know, we have to start a new regime altogether from the grassroots that cleanses us of the traditions of genocide and bloodshed. And that's my final 2 cents. What are your final words? We got 2 minutes.
You know, in addition to what you're saying, I think you hit on something really powerful here. This is blowback, but I want to bring in the planet and the energetics that are there. I mean, this planet has been around a very long time, and it takes care of itself pretty well. And when something on its surface has not learned its lessons or is acting as if it's its own virus or a cancer, which could be very well human beings and all the toxicities that we have just, you know, poured out everywhere, there's going to be blowback in that way. So we need to really be aware that if we can kind of step in and sync with nature, a lot of this is going to really kind of start working inside of ourselves because we're of the same thing. We're nature beings. We're of the same stuff. And so allowing that to be a reality also helps.
That's a good thing. Make a note of that, Deb. That's a good thing to lead into next week because that's a whole other discussion too. And thank you again for coming on. I just think it's important that people, I hope you have been listening and been taking notes. We appreciate your feedback. Write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com, republicofcanada.ca, and murderbydecree.com. It's also very important that those of you who are listening, who are part of these common law assemblies, ask yourself, okay, we've talked the theory, we've got the charter, now what do we do? What you do is very simple. You know the problem in your communities, you start taking back power. And we've got different projects going on about that. One example is that we have in North Winnipeg community gardens that have started up. People realize they've got to start feeding themselves because if they start restricting food supplies, it's a practical issue. We're setting up common law courts and sheriffs. And we're going to the local police and saying, come to our workshops. Take the oath to the people and the Constitution of a Republic, not a genocidal regime called the Crown of England, which is now null and void, regardless of how many people claim they're now the King of England. Okay, so thank you, Deb. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we're going to end with another great song from Hazel Dickens from the coal fields of West Virginia called Fire in the Hole. And this is going out to all of my ancestors and teachers and mentors over the years who have brought me to this place and brought all of us. The future is ours, brothers and sisters. Stay strong. Stay clear.